You must tell me all your secrets. Remember, we must share everything together.
Again, this is Annie Rose Malamed, and you're listening to Girls, Guts, and Giallo. And today I'm here with Michael Gillespie, and we are talking about Trainspotting. And I connected with Michael on Twitter, and you're just very knowledgeable about a wide variety of topics in film, and especially in Scottish film. And when I messaged you about doing an episode, I was like, oh, what would you want to do? And you were like, well, we could do Trainspotting. And I was like, well, I wasn't going to say it. So I'm glad you suggested it.
Possibly qualify me, yeah.
So, Michael, can you tell the listeners a little bit about who you are?
I have a degree in from the university in media theory with production. And after that, I've done a number of odd jobs here and there, but I worked in London for a year or so for a corporate video production company turned out to be not entirely legitimate. And my boss was something of a character, shall we say. This is my credentials for talking this movie, obviously. So then I had a pretty crazy year of that. And after that, I worked as a digital media intern for the Glasgow Film Theatre and the Glasgow Film Festival. I did that for a time. And I was the DVD section editor at the Skinny magazine in Leith, of all places, in Edinburgh. And so I wrote film reviews, articles, that kind of thing for the film section and the deviant section as well. So, at the moment, as I say, I now live stateside for 10 years. Hopefully everyone can understand. Well, hopefully everyone can understand my accent, but also hopefully people back home don't think I sound too transatlantic because I'll never hear the end of it.
Yeah, you're going to lose your cred.
Think I've turned into Sheena Easton or Gerard Butler, So, can you say Gerard Butler's name the right way?
Can I say whose name the right way?
The lead actor from Dracula 2000.
No.
Right. My brother's name is Gerard. That's what I'm getting.
I love that we're already talking about Dracula 2000.
Right, oh, yeah. Well, that film was absolutely spectacular. But
So I am very, and I'm probably also going to probably ask you to repeat yourself a few times, because one of my favorite parts about doing this research was how contemptful Scottish people were of how the accents had to be changed for the movie to appeal to an American audience, because we're plebes and we don't understand anything.
Well, it's interesting because even in England, they really struggle with some of the accents as well. The film is actually it's not as colloquial as the book is, because the book is much more specific to Edinburgh and Leith and that very East Coast Leith working class dialect. The film is a little bit more generic, sort of working class Scottish accent. It sort of could easily be a little bit Glasgow, a little bit East Coast, West Coast. It's got a kind of mix of all of them. But for the English audience, I mean, even they struggled with some of the accents. And when it was released in the US, they re-recorded, I think, the first 20 minutes to make the accent softer, which I only heard fairly recently because I was looking up YouTube clips. And I heard the really softened version of the Choose Life speech. It's one of the most bizarre things. And Peter Mullen, especially, in that he plays the Mother Superior, Swanee, his accent in that whole section is one of the weirdest things I've ever heard. Because Peter Mullen has got the roughest Glasgow accent you've ever heard in your life, like this, And you know, it's the line about Sick Boy has no moral fibre. And he says, well, he knows a lot about Sean Connery. And it's changed. He knows a lot about Sean Connery. it sounded like Italian or something. It's one of the weirdest things I've ever heard. But like when Movie Made in My Hometown, Sweet 16, Ken Loach film, when that was first shown on British TV, it had subtitles. They actually had to include subtitles because the accents are so thick, you know, and it's that very thick West Coast accent that people really struggle, outside of there, people really struggle with it.
Yeah, I mean, I watched the In Your Face documentary that you sent me about Irvin Welsh, and some of the reenactments they were doing for the book, you know, that it's not clips from the movie, it's reenactments specifically for the documentary. I really could, and I was telling Michael before we started recording, it's like reading A Clockwork Orange for me. It's like, it's a completely different dialect. And I know that when they released the movie, they reissued the book along with a glossary for the American audiences, which is hilarious.
Criterion Laserdisc as well had something similar. I've seen that kind of glossary of terms with the lines. But you get the gist of it, right? I mean, did you need subtitles when you rewatched it?
When I'm taking notes, I usually always watch with subtitles just because it helps me with my notes. But yeah, I mean, I definitely, the movie, not so much, right? Because they toned it down a lot. But yeah, no, I definitely still needed them. And it's sometimes like for me listening to a completely different language. It is a different dialect.
Well, it's recognised by the UNESCO as an actual language in Scots, not terms of Scots English, but Scots is recognised. And it's interesting because I was reading how social media has actually made people much more, not internationally, it's made people more aware of it, but it's also made Scottish people themselves much more confident in their usage of it and their way of understanding it. And because the interesting thing is that the book is not written in terms of the spelling and that kind of thing. It's not written by a kind of, there are certain rules people like to have about how you write the word. Like when we say head, we say heat. But like in So Am I the Next Murderer, you know, like, heat, pants down. So things like heat would normally be written H-E-I-D. And that seems to be like an unwritten rule that heat should be spelled H-E-I-D. So Irvin Welsh didn't necessarily abide by those. He just wrote it phonetically. So as I say, the fact that Scots English is now being spoken, used a lot more on social media and YouTube, people on YouTube videos, everything else are using it a lot more. It's actually helped and heightened people's understanding and confidence with it.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And the term Trainspotting too, so it's based on, and we were talking a little bit about this before we started recording, it's obviously based on a book by Irvin Welsh from 1993. And I read most of the book before we recorded this episode, and it was a challenge to get into it, but you know, once you do, you can sort of div in from vibes what people are talking about. And
well, it's like Shakespeare, or you know, like, you know, like you get the gist of it, you get the kind of the vibe of it. And as I say, the audio versions are definitely,
yeah you were saying there's one with different actors. And the title, this is like not a term that we have in the States. It's a colloquial, in my understanding, mostly like 1980s term. I don't know if people still use it.
It's the actual hobby of train spotting is still a thing.
Okay.
If you talk about someone being a train spotter, it can literally, what it is somebody who stands at train stations and takes numbers of trains and stuff, and they have their whole collection. It's like a railway enthusiast, you know.
Okay. Kind of like bird watching.
Yeah, it's like that, you know, usually. And there's a stereotype of how they look, anorak and the woolly hat, the big, huge national health glasses, and the kind of, you know, socially inept and that kind of thing, you know. So that's the type of it. But as I say, a train spotter. So you would say, I am someone that is a train spotter, or like a movie train spotter, or a football train spotter, or something like that. You know, that's kind of how it's used. It was my. It's interesting because when I first became aware of this, it was on a family. Well, my dad was a draftsman, so he occasionally would work in Edinburgh. He worked contracts. So if you got a contact for a shipyard, Brown Brothers in Edinburgh, he would go to Edinburgh and he would stay there during the week and he would come home on the weekend. And during school holidays, my mother and I would go and see him. And we'd have little holidays in Edinburgh. So I kind of, I've got this great affection for Edinburgh that I don't think the rest of my siblings have, because I was kind of, you know, I spent a lot of childhood there and I really liked it. But I remember when the book first came out and it was just everywhere. I mean, I'm like 10 years old, so I'm way too young to be into it. But I remember it just being absolutely everywhere. And I remember picking up a copy and just seeing the title Trainspotting and the cover of the guys with the skull faces and the knives and reading the back of it and reading what it's about. And I thought, right, well, it was probably my first awareness of irony. You know, I'm a first aware of counterpoint of this type of train spotting, but clearly it's not about train spotting, it's about the opposite of train spotting. You know?
Right, yeah.
It's the idea of heroin addicts and train spotters, the idea that they are kind of two sides of the same coin, that it's a kind of subculture that only really makes sense to people who are inside that subculture. Everyone else finds it strange or weird or unpleasant or whatever it is.
Yeah, that's a very good summary. And also, does it also refer to, you think, like the niche interests that the characters in the book have? Like the obsession with Sean Connery?
Well, the obsession with Sean Connery is just the Scottish thing. That's, I mean, Sean Connery at this time, especially, I mean, he was still very much an A-list star, you know. So, because in the book, of course, you know, Sick Boy has that kind of, there's that device it uses of Sick Boy has, like, his imaginary friend, Sean Connery, like there's an imaginary friend version of Sean Connery that he has, and he clearly aspires to be Sean Connery. And I think what that was because it's really just an issue of representation. You know, Sean Connery for many years was the Scottish actor, and he was very much, and he was the Scottish movie star, really until Ewan McGregor, he was the only Scottish movie star. And it wasn't just that he was Scottish, and he still sounded Scottish, he still sounded working class, but the character he was best known for, the role he was best known for, was basically the coolest guy on the planet. You know, it was the epitome of 60s cool and the 60s kind of revolution, cultural revolution of the 1960s of, you know, working class heroes and, you know, the upward mobility and internationalism, 60s swinging, 60s cool and all that stuff. You know, Sean Connery really seemed to embody, and the Angry Young Men, from Albert Finney and Peter Toole and Oliver Reed and all those guys. So Sean Connery is sort of, he's between all those worlds, he's navigating all those worlds, and he is, as I say, the coolest guy on the planet. He's the man that, you know, every, you know, boy watching James Bond movies, he's one of James Bond. You know, it's just like, he's just the coolest guy in the world, right? So, yeah, like, so the Sean Connery thing is that. It's almost like there is a kind, for a long time, there was a kind of deification of Sean Connery in Scotland for a long time, so. Yeah, but as I say, I think, boy, a Sean Connery transport. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Did you read the book when it came out, or you just saw it?
I saw the movie long before I read the book.
My
first awareness of the movie was because of Dale Winton. You know, the game show host during the withdrawal sequence?
Okay.
Yeah, he was a real-life game show host. He presented the British version of Supermarket Sweep. And this is funny, right? This is how I first became aware of a movie coming out, because my brother had the book, and he loved it. The book was like, you had to have the book. It was the coolest book you could have, and it was sold in records, and record stores started selling books at that point, so that became like this kind of, it was tied in with rock and roll, it was tied in with, obviously, the whole kind of rave culture that was happening at the time and that kind of thing. So it was very much like, if you're into all that, you have to get this book. You know, the movie I became aware of because Dale Winton made it into the tabloids that Dale Winton was appearing in it, and it was presented by the tabloids as this kind of Dale Winton and shocking Edinburgh drugs and sex shocking film. You know, and it was trying to turn it in because he had basically petitioned to be in it. In the book, I think that's Bruce Forsyth who presented the British versions of Dancing with the Stars and Card Sharks and Price is Right, and there was no way he was going to do it. Dale Winton read the book, absolutely loved it, and petitioned the filmmaker and says, you know, I will happily do this. I want to be in this. I love this book and everything. So that was my first awareness of the movie, was Dale Winton. When this came out, just how big a deal it was. Mm. I mean, Film 4 knew they had something special with it. They were kind of riding on the success of Four Weddings and a Funeral 2 years earlier. So there was great confidence in the industry at that point. So this movie coming out, they knew they had something special with it. So there was a big market. The marketing for it, I think, was almost as expensive as the film itself. And they were really seeing this as the British Pulp Fiction or the British Wild at Heart or any of those very 90s hip, cool, kind of sort of crime movie adjacent, you know, rock music adjacent kind of movies that were coming out at the time. So when it came out, it was a big hype deal, but it was an 18 certificate, so I couldn't see it. My brothers, my sister, they all saw it. They all loved it. It was shown in TV very, very quickly. I mean, it was shown pretty much by, like, I think November of 96. It came out start of the year. November 96, it's on TV. It's on video, and then right, as soon as it's out on video, it's out on TV. So I watched it with my two cousins, who... I got in trouble for... My sister got in trouble for letting me watch Pulp Fiction. And then my brother, because he's like, "Shut up, watch that." And then I got in trouble for letting them watch Pulp Fiction. So me and my two cousins, we had this weird thing. We'd always watch these films for the first time, you know, and like, it was always a big, "Have you seen that? Have you watched that? We're not allowed to watch it, but we're going to watch it." So we watched that in their house. And their house is in a really dodgy part of town, which is like part of a kind of territorial conflict over heroin. In the actual area of town that we watched it in. It was like the most appropriate place you could watch it in that way, you know?
Right.
So I watched it like 13 years old, maybe 14. And it just, like, it's weird because once it was shown in TV, that's when everybody sees it. It was already a gigantic hit. That's when everyone sees it. And it goes from being, you know, big hit movie to full-blown just cultural phenomenon to the point now where it's just part of the atmosphere in Scotland. You know, it's, for example, you say to someone in Scotland, someone says in Scotland, they're going for a job interview. Immediately, you will reference the job interview sequence. Immediately, "Oh, so my pleasure, not other people's leisure." You know, that will come up. You know, it's one of those things. Every aspect of it has just become part of the kind of vernacular of the place, you know?
Which is amazing because it's a movie about outsiders and outcasts and people that we're not supposed to see and talk about. So that's pretty incredible that it's reached that status. I mean,
yeah, Total Film magazine had their best British, they had their best British movies, and this was number one a couple of years after. And the reason that was given for why was that people said, you know, it was the film that most resembled their lives, which is like strange to think. Well, it's about, you know, a heroin addict. It's about people doing really quite extreme stuff and live very extreme lives. But it's still incredibly relatable. They're archetypes. They remind you of who you are yourself in so many ways, of being young and all these things. And I think that's why it takes off all across the UK, it takes off all across America, Europe, everywhere. People love this film, you know?
And it's just so cool. It's such a cool movie. And it's a cool book, too. I mean, it was... you know, booted off for consideration for the 1993 Booker Prize, but it was also like being passed around like a drug, people said. The book becomes the substance. And yeah, Irvin Welsh, he I believe made a documentary in 2020 about how basically it is a rite of art to offend people, and it's called Offended by Irvin Welsh.
I never saw it.
Yeah, I never saw it either. But he's like he's a provocateur. He, you know, he really wanted to. In the documentary you sent me, he said that, you know, this was like one of the first pieces of art that really spotlighted the heroin epidemic in Scotland, because most were focused on the States.
And it's because that I don't want to talk a bit about what actually happened, what the background for it was.
I think that would be good.
So I mean, the 1980s in Edinburgh, so it's the obviously it's the period of, you know, Thatcherism, and in America you've got Reaganism, and both kind of neoliberal philosophy of, you know, privatization and all these things. So Edinburgh is also an industrial city, and the industries are being out of it, so it's hit very hard. And it's also there was also a kind of Edinburgh clearances post-war, where a lot of the kind of the slum flats and stuff were cleared out, and people like Irvin Welsh moved out to these estates, housing estates like Newhouse. And so what happens is in the 1980s, so there's a lot of unemployment, you know, poverty, things are pretty rough. And simultaneously, there's also the Russia and Afghanistan. And in Afghanistan, they've decided that in order for arms, they're selling heroin, selling opium. And so that creates more of a market in the UK for heroin. And so what happens in Scotland, of course, is in Gorgie, in Edinburgh, there's the McFarlane Smith pharmaceutical plant, which produces all the pharmaceutical heroin for the UK. And I think and elsewhere, actually, exports as well. What then happens is, of course, this people start to smuggle heroin out of there, and it's very pure. It's known at the time as China White, which is everyone else said people thought it was from China. And then it just gradually starts to be used by people, but it's very kind of invisible. It's not that well known that people are using it, you know, because it had never really, as he said, this was never really a thing in the UK, really, heroin. It never became a thing in the UK quite to the extent that it did in the US or anywhere else. So it starts to become a thing, and as he said, he, in the 1980s, gets involved with it. He gets involved with it with, I think, a friend of his, and he says, it was this thing of, if I'm going to do it, you'll do it. We'll both do it together. And it's this codependent relationship that he had, which he says is very much the Red Sick Boy relationship. He understands now that's where that. So, yeah, so he becomes addicted. And then, of course, gradually over time, it goes from being an invisible phenomenon to very much being a visible one. And it coincides with the AIDS crisis. So, of course, Edinburgh simultaneously becomes the intravenous heroin capital of Europe and the AIDS capital of Europe. And it's Muirhouse is kind of the ground zero for it. And it's brutal. It's, what is ultimately done about it, there's walk-in clinics for needles are introduced, and that helps a lot. In 2017, something similar happened in Glasgow because the shut down walk-in clinics, which is one of the most strange things I could ever have done. So this is during this period, you know, Irvine Welsh is writing a diary while he's on heroin. He's on it for about a year and a half before he gets off it. But he's on admission. He's not an addict because he's not self-medicating. He's not, he's not got some neurodivergence. He's not got trauma. He's not got a physical ailment. He's not a born addict. He doesn't have an addictive personality. He gets into it just through a kind of interest in, you know, Lou Reed and Iggy Pop and that kind of thing, and just thinking, well, if these are good, I'm going to try it, you know. So that's kind of where that's kind of the background for the book, you know. And you've also got to remember the whole thing with syringes, because this is a thing that only really exists in Edinburgh at the time. This is why Edinburgh, more so than other parts of the UK where heroin's a thing, is because syringes are, a lot of people say that this goes back to the Enlightenment, because Edinburgh being obviously very much a hub of the Enlightenment, that's where the pharmaceutical heroin industry, that's where that started. Going back to, you know, the Shell Pold period, obviously, most famous heroin addict and fiction there is. So that goes back there, and needles and the use of hypodermic needles as well was, they were more common around Edinburgh. It was easier to get hold of, easier to use them. And then, as the likes of Welsh and other people have talked about, and filmmakers have talked about, the needle itself becomes addictive. You know, jabbing the needle in and of itself, physically, that sensation, that becomes part of the addiction.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so I mean, this is kind of the background for the book. So he keeps a diary, and that forms the basis for what becomes the book Trainspotting, which is, that forms the basis for it.
Yeah, I actually had no idea that Edinburgh was such a capital of heroin usage and of the HIV epidemic. Like, this was something I learned doing this research, and it was something like 60% of HIV cases at this time were in Edinburgh. So that's wild. I mean, I actually had no idea. So it's learning about that was really changed, actually, my understanding of this book and film, just like really enriched it. And it also, I saw so much more how Welsh is purposely offending these sort of middle class sensibilities and exposing this really, you know, ugly truth. Like, Welsh, like you said, started using sort of as a way to fit in with his milieu, and but he's very aware of the fact that most people use because of the terrible circumstances that they're in. And this is a very pleasurable thing to experience amongst abject poverty, you know. He says these clubs, these parties and drugs, they were not luxuries, they were essential. So it's this, and this film too, when I was, you know, and of course it gets filtered through like the Danny Boyle lens, so it's a bit different than the book, very different than the book, but the it's very much focused on pleasure. Like you said, that line about pleasure is something that has become part of the colloquialism of of Scotland.
My pleasure and other people's pleasure. Yeah. Because it's interesting, because the movie only, the HIV situation isn't really, apart from the character of Tommy and what happens to him, it's not talked about that much, whereas the book, it's every page, you know, almost is talking about it. And there's, of course, that chapter, Bad Blood, which, did you get to that chapter yet, or...?
I'm not sure. I don't remember actually the chapter names.
All right. Well, it's the story about Davy Mitchell and Alan Venters.
Okay. You can remind me what happens.
Oh my God.
I'm like in a haze, Michael.
Right. Okay. Well, I don't know if I want to get it. It's absolutely horrifying, this story. It's
Is it the rape scene?
There isn't one in that. There's a reference to a rape in it, but it's not a rape scene, but there is a, it's a revenge story, but it's about this guy, Davy Mitchell, who in the book is the guy that has the morning after, you know, bed linen scatological situation in the book. That's what happens to him.
Okay.
Yeah, so he gets HIV positive and he goes to a support group, and there's a guy there, because there's a guy there as well who's HIV positive, Alan Venters. And he talks about how he wants to get close to this guy Venters and become friends with him, because he wants to take revenge upon him, because he's an absolute psychopath and he's done this horrible, terrible thing. And he can't figure out how to take revenge upon him, because the guy is so without compassion or empathy that it's hard to find something he cares about. But then he does find something he cares about, and I'm not going to say any more, but it really pulls the rug from under your feet, that story. It is absolutely brutal.
Okay, did not read that one. I would remember.
There was a short film adaptation of it starring Alan Cumming, but I've not seen it. I've not been able to track it down or anything.
Oh, interesting. I'll look into that. I've got many people in my Discord server that are very good at things like that. But I did read the very extremely graphic story about the gang rape. And they did not include that in the film, which I thought was an interesting choice. I mean, the film is a lot more lighthearted than the book.
The film is very toned down, but it's much more palatable. It's much more, Irvin Welsh, he's a hard writer to adapt, because if you look at something like The Acid House, have you seen The Acid House?
Yeah, I've seen the movie.
What's that?
I saw the film. I haven't read the book.
Yeah. I think the film is terrible. The problem with that
film is it's not very memorable.
Right. It's unfiltered Irvin Welsh. That was how it was built. And that's kind of the problem. If you don't filter it through another sensibility, it's just ugly. It's just really, in prose it works okay, because there's a distance you've got when you're reading it. Or there's simultaneously a distance and an intimacy, because it's inside your head, effectively. When it's visualized, when it's done that way, it's when it's done in that unfiltered way, it's just really ugly and really, you don't want to look at it, you don't want to listen to it, you just think the character's impossible to care about or anything else. Whereas if you look at something like Filth is, I mean, it's probably about as good an adaptation of that book as you could get, because I don't know if you know the book, or have you seen the film Filth?
No, I haven't. I only saw clips from it in some of the research I did.
Right, yes, one with James McAvoy. I mean, the film is about as good an adaptation of the book as you could ever make, because the book is really disgusting. I mean, it's just... It's
well, now I want to read it.
Right. Well, it's inside the head of this really corrupt policeman, and he's... Everything about him is just repulsive. You know, he's bigoted, he's a psychopath, even just the way that he describes all the things he does in his daily life. So it's very scatological, it's very all these things. He's just repulsive in every way. So being in that guy's head for that length of time, it's really grotty. So the film has to tone it down considerably, and it has to tone it down to get to a lot of the humour, and it just wouldn't work otherwise, you know, because it's a very tough... I just think he's not not the most, because he said he'd like to have all of his work adapted, but he is a tricky writer to adapt. You really need to have the sensibility of like a Danny Boyle or someone to really do it justice, or at least to bring something else to it, to enable it to be, you know, palatable, to make it something else, you know? Because the book and the film are very different, and I think that's actually what's great about it. You know, it's because it wouldn't be the same. If you did a most, you couldn't just be out.
I mean, Renton is just, like, irredeemable in the book. Yeah. So, you just wouldn't be able to sympathize. You wouldn't be able to, which I kind of would be interested in seeing, but I also understand that. Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen Filth, but I'll believe you that it's difficult to be with that character.
Even Begbie, I mean, Begbie in the book is a thousand times worse than he is. Mm-hmm.
They all Begbie are. Because
Begbie in the film is, you know, a psycho. He's a psycho, right? But in the book, they're all psychos.
Begbie's well, in the film, worse, you know? In the film, he's a psycho, but it's more humorous. And there is a lot of black humor in the book that is really pushed in the movie. And it's this, you know, this addict gallows humor. You know, anyone who's been to a 12-step meeting will tell you that that's like a very important part of that culture is the gallows humor. I mean, when you've touched the edge of death so closely, you see the absurdity of the life that we're living. But yeah, the James McAvoy, the Filth movie, is that the one where it's kind of like the reversal of the train spotting opening, where he's walking through and he's like, oh, being Scottish is fucking great, instead of in train spotting when he is that the one, is that the right clip that I'm thinking of?
Not quite. It's not really referencing. The opening is him walking around. He walks through Edinburgh and he's just kind of saying, you know, you're Scotland, we bit the deep fried Mark Bar and all these things. And it's not really referencing. I wouldn't say it's referencing. I would never have thought it was referencing Trainspotting. Mm. I think that movie, interestingly, was very consciously avoiding Trainspotting. Mm. They were really trying not to. They never mentioned it whenever they were in meetings, pitch meetings, anything. They always did everything they could to avoid referencing Trainspotting when they talked about it. You know, it was like, we don't want another Trainspotting, you know.
Yeah, it would be hard to live in the shadow of that film.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the other thing that kind of struck me was that there's a real lack of fully formed female characters in the book and the movie, and especially with discussing the rape scene. What I found very interesting about the Irvin Walsh documentary was there was only one woman who is from a very prolific Scottish feminist organization. I forget the name, but she, you probably will know it, but she is saying that she's talking about what the criticism of the rape and the misogyny in the book.
That's in Marabou Stork Nightmares, that book that she's referred to.
Oh, that, okay. Yeah. So she, yeah. So
that's Stork Nightmares, yeah.
So she's very critical of his representations of women and sexual violence. And I actually don't really, I understand what she's saying, but I don't actually agree with her. So I was sort of, I was annoyed that there was all these men sort of saying things that I feel like I agree with them, but it could be said better by a woman who with a feminist sensibility who enjoys the book and or the film, or, you know, Irvin Welsh's writing overall. But anyway, I think that would be an interesting thing to talk about in the movie, because Kelly MacDonald's character, Diane, gets flattened into like an amalgamation of the peripheral female characters. Yeah. In the book, which is an interesting choice. And she's not really, I mean, I love her character, but she's also just kind of there to be a sexual interest.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, that documentary, I mean, that was like 27 years ago. Mm-hmm. So it has been reappraised, and he has changed any views, and he's got a reputation. You know, he's sometimes quite reactionary about things. And then he says he always tries to remain open and tries to, you know, evolve and these kind of things, you know. But he used a trans sensitivity reader on his last book, you know, so You know, he said he's always trying to, even if he's, you know, some things going backwards on things that he seems reactionary to things, he always tries to understand and learn and move on. Because he says, because you kind of have to, it's just the way the world is.
Yeah, I definitely got that sense from doing research on him now. He's definitely, like, he talks about his right to offend, but he also says that to him the most offensive thing is bigotry. So he's aware of... he could change and evolve, and he's definitely, like you've said, he said some reactionary things, but at the same time he's like, you know, I've changed, I'm a human being, like I changed my mind.
He also has that, you know, that kind of waddish kind of misanthropy that, you know,
right,
that is very much a part of Nate's culture in the UK as well, but, you know, we'll get to that later, but yeah, there is a lot of that there as well, you know.
So let's talk a little bit about, so I want to move into talking about the actual production of the film and, you know, Danny Boyle's version of the story. But then I'm also going to ask you to talk a little bit about Ladsploitation after that. So let's talk about Danny Boyle, the trio of Danny Boyle, Andrew McDonald, and John Hodge, which was this directing, producing, and writing trio behind the 1994 hit Shallow Grave, which I love that movie.
I'm not loving it, but I do like it.
So Danny Boyle is actually an English director. And I feel like you probably better understand the nuances going on here, but I was actually wondering about this English director making such a Scottish story and if that was controversial at the time.
No, I don't remember. There was never any kind of talk about it or anything. I mean, he was respectful, and he didn't try to tone things down. Or, like I say, Ken Loach has made several movies in Scotland. You know, My Name is Joe and Sweet 16 in my hometown, and The Angel's Share and stuff. And I mean, like, in the case of Ken Loach, what he does, he makes films all over. And wherever he goes, whatever the local accent dialogue, you know, whatever that is, that's what he does. You know, he's a social realist, so it's always about, well, we're going to be true to whatever we are completely. So in that regard, he's an English director, but he makes films in Scotland, and he does them really Scottish. And Danny Boyle, interesting. I mean, I don't think there was any controversy. I mean, the rest of the team at Figment, of course, there's John Hodge and Andrew McDonald are Scottish. Andrew McDonald is, of course, the grandson of Emeric Pressburger. And Danny Boyle's an interesting one. I mean, he's sort of, his background, you know, was in TV. There's a lot of directors in the UK have backgrounds in TV. And his mentor was Alan Clark, the filmmaker who made Scum and The Firm with Gary Oldman and Penn the Sven, which has had a bit of a kind of renaissance of late, you know, with the folk horror revival. He made Penn the Sven, and he made Billy the Kid and the Green Days Vampire, which is a bit of a weird one, and he also made Elephant, which was the inspiration for the Gus Van Sant film. If you put all those things together, I mean, that's films about various aspects of the UK, British identity, but it's also football hooliganism, it's Northern Ireland sectarianism, it's experimental filmmaking, it's weird, wacky genre filmmaking, and it's violent transgressions. You put all that together, you get Danny Boyle, and you get Trainspotting, you know. So I don't ever remember him being English ever, but I think people might actually have thought he was Scottish for a while before they heard him speaking. He's got that accent, like, that Danny Boyle, you know, I don't think there was ever any issue there.
Yeah, I literally thought he was Scottish until I did this research. I was like, oh, wow, okay. So, yeah, so Shallow Grave was a big hit in the UK. The trio was compared to Tarantino and Hitchcock. And they, interestingly, instead of, you know, of course the calls were coming from Hollywood, but instead of moving on to Hollywood, the trio shunned the overseas hotline. They take £1.5 million and they hire this up-and-coming talent, and they decide to adapt Irvin Welsh's Trainspotting, which is actually written, if for listeners who haven't read the book, it's a series of vignettes concentrating on the heroin-hooked anti-hero Mark Renton and his attempts to kick the habit, despite a lack of cooperation from his similarly inclined friends. So it's this book made up of vignettes that has to be cobbled together to make a linear film, which is a big challenge. And Irvin Welsh had actually expressed that he didn't want to be involved with writing the screenplay. So we get this, we get this, you know, kind of action-y sort of, it is a very different tone, like we've been talking about, from the book. And it's also, it was shot mostly in Glasgow, correct?
Yeah, mostly Glasgow. The only, like the opening, that's Prince's Street in Edinburgh when they're running down. But yeah, the majority of it, it was an old tobacco factory was used as the location. That was most of the locations were shot in there. Mm. It's mostly shot indoors, of course. So most of the sequels are actually set indoors. So you can kind of get around it in that way. The sequel, of course, if you've seen the sequel, that is Edinburgh. That's, they've really made as much use of Edinburgh as they could for that film. But yeah, mostly shot in Glasgow. Yeah, the thing that John Hodge, apparently, when he read the book, said there's no way you can make a film out of this. You just can't make a 90-minute linear film out of this. It's just, it's like, it's, no, it's compared with the Canterbury Tales, compared with, you know, these kind of stories. And he just said, you can't make a linear movie out of this. But then the stage adaptation was what kind of gave him a way in, because that became very popular at the time, with Ewan Bremner actually playing Renton. And it does lend itself well to the stage because of how it's written, because a lot of it is just monologues. I've never seen a stage adaptation of it, I have to say. But yeah, lent itself up. But that kind of focused on Renton and the notion that giving Renton a kind of arc, that, you know, Renton's in this world and wants to get involved. And so that formed the basis. That was kind of what gave him the idea. The other one that Danny Boyle cited was Goodfellas. You know, Goodfellas gave it the structure that it has, you know, which is also what, you know, Boogie Nights and City of God used that structure as well. It works well, and it also works because it's, I mean, Goodfellas was, as Nicholas Pileggi talked about, how that came from a kind of Italian storytelling tradition of, you know, that kind of episodic nature of it. It comes from an Italian oral storytelling tradition, and of course this is a Celtic storytelling tradition. Mm. So in that regard, it works well in approximating the book and what the spirit of the book in that way. You know, that kind of, that Goodfellas structure works really well for it in that way.
Yeah, it's... I'm just taking in what you said. That's the comparison between the Italian story and the Celtic storytelling is very interesting. I'm like, I want to hear more about that, but I also feel like we should move on. So Ewan McGregor, this like sort of put him on the map, in my understanding. He's in these like drain pipe jeans with his shaved head and looking, what, as Empire magazine said at the time, two stone lighter than usual. And the cast were on these kind of crazy diets to look like heroin users. So that must have been, I don't know. I feel like making this was like its own endurance test.
Yeah, I mean, Ewan McGregor, he did say he did genuinely consider taking heroin. And he realised after he started pre-production when he met Carlton Athletic, who are the, Carlton Athletic are like that's a heroin, they're all former addicts, they have a football club and they, you know, they don't use methadone, they help each other, you know, and they're in the sequel as well. They're in the opening scene of the movie when they're playing football. When I say football, I mean...
Yeah, I know what you mean.
I'm not going to say that word, right? Yeah. I'll say restroom, you know. I'll say all these sidewalk, the worst restroom in Scotland, I'll say that. But no, I'm not
calling it soccer.
Not the mathematical monstrosity you call football here. No. So when they're playing at the start, that the team they're playing, that's actually Carlton Athletic. But it said when he spoke to them, and they gave them all a crash course in how to cook and how to do all these things. You know, as he says, when he spoke to them, he realised, he says, because they've obviously spent years trying to get off it and battling it and dealing with the, you know, relapsing and all these other issues, all the familial, personal issues that go with it. And they said, you know, he realised that it was actually wouldn't have been a good idea to take it. You know, he realised that he was only taking it, he was using it as an excuse in a very pretentious actor way, but also in the way that Irvine Welsh talked about, seeing it as this rock and roll thing. Like, it's not rock and roll, it's, it becomes a way of life, and it's broken, you know.
Right.
So he didn't do that, but he talked about, he did, like, really starved himself and really kind of. And the other interesting thing, of course, is Johnny Lee Miller kept his Scottish accent the entire time he was making it, because he was slightly too scared to go out in pubs in Glasgow with an English accent. So he kept his Scottish accent up the entire time. Because he's English. He's also significantly, he's the grandson of Bernard Lee, who played M in the original Bond movies.
Oh, okay. Yeah, see, this is why I asked if it was controversial if Danny Boyle was English.
Yeah, well, I can imagine, well, he's got a kind of Scouse accent. You're okay if you've got that accent in Scotland, you're all right. You know, it's another working class regional accent. You're okay. If he was posh in English, if he spoke like this, he might be a bit in trouble, but no. So that was because they realised he was Bernard Lee's grandson, and they said, right, well, that's, we've got to get him playing the James Bond obsessed character, you know, so. But yeah, the production was, because of course Robert Carlyle's casting was a bit of an odd one, because of course he couldn't envision himself, because he had used monologues and stuff from the book and the theatre group that he was in Glasgow at the time, using, they were doing little sort of unlicensed adaptations of the book at the time, and he played all the characters, but he could never envision himself as Bond. And it was Danny Boyle that said, you know, small size was mysterious. And he kind of, so, I mean, he is kind of the equivalent of Joe Pesci in Goodfellas. I mean, because of course, the guy that character is based on was a huge big guy. And similarly, Begbie was always envisioned as a big guy. And of course, they got Robert Dallas. So that worked it. I mean, it completely works. It's just, because it's just, that is something absolutely terrifying with someone like that who isn't a big guy, but he doesn't care. He's completely, he will keep coming at you, and he isn't. Because there's a whole thing in the book about how Tommy, you know, you say, if it ever came to a fight between him and Tommy, Tommy could take it. The difference is, Begbie wouldn't just take it. Begbie would have to go get a knife or a baseball bat or something else to finish the job. That's making him different to anyone else, you know?
You're right. He's totally the Joe Pesci character. That's so true. So there, and they also, like we said, they toned down the accents a lot because it would help sell the film. In America, I do love, I mean, as an American who hates Americans, I do love when they beat up the American in the movie. But
first of all, what's great about that moment is the outfit that guy's wearing. That is what every single American tourist in Edinburgh looks like. I don't know why. With a baseball cap and the big red anor, that they all look like that. I don't know why. it's just
that's so funny. Oh, God. Yeah, I mean, going to the UK as an American tourist is so embarrassing. I mean, I've been, but I haven't been to Scotland, but I've been to Ireland and the North and everything. And people usually didn't clock me as American, which maybe is a good thing. Okay. Usually people thought I was like Romani for some reason. So
Canadian, I guess.
Yeah. Maybe Canadian. Yeah.
If you've ever asked a Canadian if they're American, that was something I learned living in the UK, you know. If you hear the accent, ask if they're Canadian first, because a Canadian will get really annoyed if you ask if they're American.
So
you
know, funny.
It's like New Zealanders get angry if you ask if they're Australian, you know, that kind of thing.
Right. So then when the movie came out, it did garner a lot of comparisons to A Clockwork Orange. And question for you, which I feel like that the Clockwork Orange comparison is sort of related to, is I want to hear from you about Ladsploitation and the Hooligan movie and how something like Trainspotting would have led to that phenomenon or that genre.
Yeah, I mean, well, like I say, the guy I worked for, he made films that would be termed Ladsploitation now. Let's see. So the whole kind of phenomenon of films about kind of, you know, hooligans and, you know, kind of delinquent character and stuff. I mean, we mentioned Alan Clark already, you know, making films like Scum and the like. And the original TV movie of Scum was actually banned by the BBC. That's why they remade it as a feature. You've seen Scum, right?
I know what it is, but I haven't seen it.
Right, sure. Well, yeah, it's about Borstal in the UK. But that's a movie that has lasted, incidentally. I mean, that was a film that when I was in high school, everybody said it was on TV. some scum last night. You see that bit with Snickerballs, you know, that becomes this thing, you know. But yeah, so those kind of sort of transgressive youth films, you know, so Clockwork Orange. Clockwork Orange, interestingly, I hadn't seen when I saw Trainspotting because Kubrick had withheld it from release in the UK. So didn't see it until the end of the decade. I read the book and knew the soundtrack before I ever saw the movie. But the last point to say, where this sort of comes from is after Trainspotting, the visual language of British cinema really changes after that. So the notion that a British movie looks a certain way, sounds a certain way, is kind of out the window. You know, Danny Boyle is in the tradition I mentioned, like Henrik Pressburger earlier. He is in that great tradition of Michael Powell and, Michael Powell and people like Nicholas Rogue and Donald Cammell and, Ken Russell and those kind of guys. He's not making realist cinema. He's not making capital A art cinema either. I mean, the makers of this talked about the idea that they were trying to find a sweet spot between Peter Greenaway and Arnold Schwarzenegger. You know, that kind of audience wasn't being catered to. That kind of middle ground, you know? So this is that very, the idea of this very fast visual, you know, language, this very slightly music video inspired kind of look that it has, very energetic, very vibrant, very young. That gradually, you know, seeps its way into other British TV and British movies. And probably, I mean, like I said, four key British movies of the 90s are Four Weddings and a Funeral, then this, then the film Monty, which Rock Hall also went, and then at the end of the decade, it's Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. That's very much the first sort of post-Trainspotting film of that type, because that's obviously like a crime movie, gangster movie. It's owing a lot to, you know, 60s movies the way this is. Now, this film has a lot in common with things like, you know, Alfie was cited as a big influence, and, you know, that movie Lock, Stock is basically the Italian Job. It was called at the time, the blurb was, The Long Good Friday for the Trainspotting Generation, which is not true because it's the Italian Job for the Trainspotting Generation. It's nothing like The Long Good Friday. But that movie, again, has that same energy, and it was very much feeding into the new lad culture of the 1990s in the UK. Now, that where that comes from, right, the comedian Frank Skinner, he was this working-class, Brummy comedian who became very famous for a football related TV show, Fantasy Football. So he was seen as a kind of lad icon. And he remembers talking to Nick Hornby, the writer Nick Hornby, who wrote Fever Pitch and High Fidelity and all these other. And they were talking once, and Nick Hornby says, you realise apparently we're like the elder statesmen, or we're the kind of poster boys for the new lad movement. Did you know that? The two of them were baffled by this and found it ridiculous. It was more a phenomenon of the idea of just, you know, working class guys, lads, just doing, you know, going out drinking, maybe doing drugs, maybe, you know, having sex, trying to have sex with clubs, maybe getting in a bit of, you know, bit of leeriness, as they say, you know, maybe getting in fights or whatever, or just doing regular, ordinary, going to football, doing regular, ordinary, working class, you know, male things. That became cool for middle class people. That became a sort of a badge of honour that middle class guys decided they were going to be lads, and they were going to, and it was partly inspired by, I mean, Oasis, and because Oasis had become a huge band at that point, and Liam Gallagher very much seen as this figure of that, so that makes it cool. That makes it, now it's not just some guy in the street, now it's the biggest rock star, you know, in the world, is this kind of guy. So suddenly, as Frank Skinner said, you've got middle class guys who, rather than, you know, they're going out and getting drunk at wine bars, and they're having fights in judo classes, but they're labelling themselves new lads, and they're buying FHM magazine and Vogue magazine and these kind of things. Now, when those things start, there's a degree of irony to them, like Vogue and FHM stuff. There's a degree of kind of having a laugh about it. As time goes on, that goes away. And the kind of staples of this whole, as in Bill's, you know, so this whole kind of phenomenon is, you know, lionization of gangsters, lionization of hooliganism, football hooligans, lionization of, you know, very deeply unpleasant, you know, celebrities like, you know, Sid James and stuff, and a kind of, you know, complete, really objectification of women, but being passed off as just lad behaviour or as a bit of a laugh or not that big of a deal. So that's sort of where the lad thing comes from. That's what Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels is very much playing to that audience and playing to, you know, that whole kind of phenomenon. It becomes a huge, huge hit at the time. And then Guy Ritchie from there, of course, goes on to make Snatch, and he marries Madonna, and he becomes a huge name, and then nearly tortures his career when he makes Swept Away in Revolver, but then reinvents himself, becomes I actually think he's a pretty good filmmaker, Guy Ritchie. I think he's made some really good films. But Guy Ritchie's also interesting because he kind of embodies that new lad phenomenon, because he is a rich kid who's cosplaying as a geezer. You know, he's this very, came from a very wealthy family, goes and lives in East End for a couple of years, where he makes music videos and stuff, and kind of mythologizes himself as a bit of an East End, you know, geezer, you know what I mean? So that, he embodies that, because in his work, there's no criticism, there's no self-awareness of that you get with, like, Irvin Welsh when he's talking about this stuff. He's just kind of enjoying it. He's not talking about the class system in any substantive way. He's just taking it as it is, and he doesn't care. So where that eventually goes is, after Lock, Stock, we get an explosion of absolutely terrible British gangster films, like Circus and Honest, directed by Dave Stewart and directed by Remix. He's never not directed a movie since, surprisingly. And we get, Love on Mineral Bay, Rancid Aluminium, You're Dead. I mean, there were just a lot of really, really bad British gangster films to it. And it became a kind of, the minute you heard the new British gangster movie, it was kind of, you just thought, heart would sink, you know, and it just became, it started to become an embarrassment that so many British gangster films were these, you know, so many British films were these terrible British gangster films. A couple of good ones come out of it. Sexy Beast is very much a post-Trainspotting film, very much. And Sexy Beast is, I absolutely love Sexy. I think Sexy Beast,
it's a great movie, yeah.
Yeah. But those are also just in a tradition of really good British gangster films that are an inspiration for a lot of stuff. So things like Performance, and you know, Get Carter, and Long Good Friday, and Mona Lisa, Villain with Richard Burton, which is kind of remake of White Heat, and you know, and then you get Sexy Beast, you get Layer Cake's all right, but you know, you get some good ones, you know. But the other thing is, they're self-aware, and they're substantive, and they have depth, and the homoeroticism of those films is not unintentional. Those very actively play with it. I mean, you look at Performance. You know, Donald Cameron got a bunch of proper East End villains to do all kinds of stuff that they would normally have done. And the film was very much played with, you know, sexual ambiguity with the James Fox character and the Mick Jagger character. You've got Carter, you've got the Joan Osborne's, you know, Feet Crime Boss, Long Good Friday, you've got, you know, Paul Freeman's character. You've got films like Missing in Between or Sleeping I'm Dead, which deal with these kind of things and stuff. So, it, you know, like, you've got Ian McShane and Sexy Beast and 44 Inch Chest, or Sleeping I'm Dead deals with, you know, male rape and stuff in prison, that kind of thing. So it's very, you know, they're not afraid of going there. And, you know, British gangsters, the lad's exploitation film that comes out of that is often characterised by being quite homophobic and not being aware of how homoerotic it actually is, you know. Where it really kicks off is with the filmmaker Nick Love, who makes The Football Factory and The Business. He makes these very zero-budget digital films with Danny Dyer, the actor Danny Dyer, who has kind of become a bit of a national treasure in the UK in recent years. He was not necessarily that popular before, but he's sort of he's kind of endeared himself to people a little bit more. But what that is that's just very zero-budget movies that creates a market, or what was it a few years ago, for supermarkets that stock these zero-budget British gangster movies, really pretty bad, often involving reality TV stars, real-life villains, real-life, you know, group from things like your pasty girls or porn or, you know, often people washed up pop stars that were, had nothing else to do. And so that creates the last exploitation. It's essentially a supermarket thing. It's essentially supermarket DVDs that get shifted in bulk, you know. The other problem, of course, is that the more toxic side of this kind of lad culture, the way that's evolved, has evolved online. And of course, it's become this whole manosphere. It's become this horrible, you know, thing. And it's interesting because when you look at a character like Sick Boy, if he was around now, right, would 100% be one of those guys. I mean, he just would. I just think everything about him, he would completely be one. If you read the book Porno as well, you know, there's a lot of that there. Sick Boy 100% would be one of those guys. He's totally, you know, we'll get into it and talk about the movie, but how Sick Boy is, but, you know,
Yeah, that's interesting. There was a British man recently who tried to explain to me that the manosphere is not a thing over there. And I was like, I feel like you're lying
Yeah.
to me. Yeah. So I feel validated, Michael. Thank you.
Right, okay, right.
I was like, there's lad culture that, like, that's a whole thing. So, yeah, but okay. And the sex appeal, like, there's a couple things I'm like, oh, I want to respond to things, but I'm sure we'll get to it when we talk about the movie. But yeah, the sex appeal, this movie is not lacking in sex appeal, in my opinion. I mean, like, the whole, like, Ewan McGregor looks so cute in this movie. Like, he's such a little cutie.
So, I read so many people, I talk to so many people who say that this is like the most attractive he's ever been.
Oh yeah.
And it's weird because given what who he's playing and what and it's like, and yet they say it's like the sexiest he's ever been,
Exactly.
But it's interesting, it's a kind of, we're talking about Clockwork Orange, it's the appeal of, you talked about pleasure, it's the appeal of a character who lives a life of pleasure,
Yes.
even if it is completely reprehensible. There's something really appealing about watching a character who enjoys what they do and revels in it, and just even if it's awful, there's something very appealing to the kind of the transgressive. There is a kind of a curious thrill you get from watching someone, even someone. I mean, we're talking, James Bond movies. That's a large chunk of the appeal of James Bond. The guy is an absolute psychopath, and a total monster of a human, but he's on our side, so it's okay. And that's
Yeah.
so much appeal is the
And he
complete.
fucks. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's not in a Marvel movie, but
Yeah.
it's the appeal of the character, is that he's free. He has no constraints on him. He can literally kill and do anything he wants and get away with it. And that's, and as I say, so Trainspotting with Renton, that's so much of what the appeal is. This guy, he loves what he, like, all the way through it, he's talking about why he loves being an addict. He genuinely just sees it as a better way of life than he, because in the book, it's interesting because when he's arrested for stealing books in the book, and of course one of them is by Kant, the philosopher Kant. And when he's in court, they do the whole thing of oh yeah, so I'm sure you're a great fan of Kant then, young man. And of course, he then gives the most smart ass response that you could ever get, because he then gives essentially a kind of Wikipedia version of Kant, explaining what Kant's like and kind of fuck you. But then what happens in a few chapters later, one of his inner monologues, he's talking about being a heroin addict. And he essentially uses Kant's philosophy to explain why he's a heroin addict. So he's very, he is philosophical about it. He's self-aware. He's incredibly cynical, obviously, but he takes so much pleasure and he's so knowledgeable about what he does that that is very, very appealing. And I know that, like, sick boy, people talk about how attractive sick. I mean, I remember watching it because, because he's, maybe that's just his character's personal vanity has got a lot to do with that. That's what that is. But yeah, they are attractive. You're absolutely right. I think a lot of that is just Danny Boyle's sensibilities. He wanted to make, you're taking these marginalized people who in real life are marginalized and making icons out of them, giving them an iconography, giving them something. I think that's where I think a lot of the, you see, the sex appeal comes from. I mean, you talked about the inspirations being films like Alfie, like we mentioned earlier. Alfie's an interesting example because Alfie's a film, and it's the same with The Hustler, which we mentioned as well. People misremember those movies. People think of those movies as, they think of themselves as Michael Caine and Paul Newman just being like super cool, just being like, oh, they kind of iconography of them, just, The films are really dark. Alfie is a really dark film. And what stops it from being unpalatable is the voiceover, which this film also had. And I think that's where they got it from. There's an intimacy you have with a character. Also, he breaks the fourth wall there, but there's the intimacy with the character kind of makes us his friend. So even when he's running around behaving in this really appalling way, we kind of are with him because we can see that he's enjoying it. Gradually, obviously, that all starts to break away, but we kind of enjoy seeing him do it. And the same with The Hustler, that's somebody who's, he's got this alcoholic girlfriend and he's living rough and he's all these things. But that kind of, again, it's Paul Newman in the suit playing pool being the coolest guy. And that's what people remember. They don't necessarily remember how dark the story is.
Yeah, I mean, we Speaking of sex appeal, this movie basically opens with a woman having an orgasm. Like, of course, it opens with, you know, the gang, they're running down the street, which Irvin Welsh loved this scene. And, you know, they're immediately positioned as railing against this, like, bourgeois middle class. It positions drug users as the outsiders of society. And they start talking about, you know, pleasure as a theme here. And there's a scene with this, the woman Alice, and she's shooting up, and she has, you know, she's basically coming, and she says, you know, oh, that beats any meat injection. So yeah.
That's a pretty good Scottish accent.
Yeah. Thank you.
That's quite impressive, actually, yeah.
Beat any fucking cock in the world. Yeah.
If you ever visit Scotland, just talk that way. Don't
yeah. Get then they'll all love me. Yeah. There's immediately also, it's funny too, because there's this baby in the background that's her baby. And, you know, the baby's going to become important later. But
the baby's kind of what you would get in a horror movie where you would have, like, the dog or the cat or the pet or something. It's this thing that is kind of always there on the peripheries, but we never, ever talk about it. They never acknowledge it. And also what happens is incredibly disturbing. But, yeah, that's kind of how the baby's used. But, yeah, the opening scene as well, where you've got, you know, sick boy, he's giving her this injection, and he's talking about Sean Connery, and he's, you know, doing the whole thing. And it's, again, it's almost distracting you from the darkness of it, because you're watching it, and what your first, for me, watching it, I'm going, oh, he loves James Bond movies. I love James Bond movies. This is so cool. What are the guys in it? You know, it becomes relatable in that way. It's that thing of, because that was a very 90s thing, you know, the characters talking about other movies and talking about pop culture and stuff that sort of said, you know, with Wild at Heart and Tarantino and all that kind of stuff. That was kind of a thing, you know. But again, it's the notion of pleasure. He's talking about watching Bond movies, you know, and he's talking about how much he enjoys as he's getting high. And of course, Spud kisses him and he tells him, fuck off, you know. And then the Mother Superior comes and he starts kind of mouthing with him as well. And that's something that's in the book as well. There is a lot of implied sexuality between the guys.
Yes.
And that is, you know, and that's very much to the fore. Yeah, and it recurs as the film, and I know we're talking about the movie now, scene by scene, as we're going through it. You know, that does recur as a kind of motif, you know, when we get to a couple of, we'll talk about it when we get to
it.
Them.
Definitely,
you know,
there yes. Is that. Their relationships are romantic, in my opinion. And
they are.
And, you know, the other thing I was noticing in these beginning scenes, which the house they're living in, is it supposed to be Muir House? I know it is in the book.
I mean, the thing is, that's the interesting thing about the film, is it is a more, it's not as specific as the book. You know, we kind of assume it's going to be a Muir House because they use photographs and stuff from there and use those as reference. But they also, it's a movie, they wanted to give it a heightened reality and everything. But yeah, that's, essentially, it is, you know, it never explicitly says it. In the same way that it never explicitly says what time period it's set in either. There's a timeless quality to it. You know, it never says it's set in the 80s, you know, because it kind of implies that maybe it's set over the course of the 80s going into the 90s, but I've never really bought that because you never ever for a minute feel like this is actually taking place over the course of several years. It feels like it's all happening very, very quickly,
yes.
You know.
Yeah. Yes, and it also, yeah, the pleasure is emphasized, and it also gives people permission to be childlike and to play. you know, they're this setting of the house that they're all in, it's very, and the way that they interact with each other, like Spud trying to kiss Renton, you know, it's very childlike almost. Like
it's like a kid. Yeah, it's like children's bed, you know. It's like a sort of, I mean, it's quite a Gen X thing as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that idea of arrested development or trying to stay young as long as possible. That was very much that's a big part of that Gen X literature and that kind of thing, you know, is that idea of not having to grow up in the same way that previous generations had, that kind of thing. That's well.
Oh, yeah, such a good point. I mean, you'd even like consider the Gen X-ness of this movie. Like, there's so many avenues we can go down here.
Yeah, yeah. I know.
No, but that's it's such a good point, and that's like something I want to talk about more actually. But there's